chair of the Public Service Commission and also head of the Power Generation Advisory Panel. Thank you very much, all of you, for to the public for joining for this important session. It's a public input session at which we solicit your thoughts on how best to shape our work, and I can talk about
100%.
You know, the nature of our work as it's been, as we've been charged with it in a few slides. And I also want to thank colleagues on the Power Generation Advisory Panel for all of their work, but also for joining us this evening in order to participate in this session. We may give some answers or responses, but primarily we're going to be listening actively and attentively to the observations,
100%.
And comments and suggestions and challenges that you will bring us, members of the public. So thank you both, colleagues and members of the public, for being here. Let me go to the next slide and kind of start to set the context. The context for all of our work is that the Power Generation Advisor Panel is a committee that is a subcommittee of the Climate Action Council, which was set up by New York's nation-leading climate and energy law, the CLCPA, which got passed about 18 months ago. And the CLCPA does a couple of things. One is it establishes some nation-leading, really important clean energy
goals.
Carbon-neutral economy, manning at least 85% reduction in emissions below 1990 levels by mid-century, taken as 2050, 40% reduction by 2030. On electricity itself, 100% zero emission electricity by 2040, and 70% renewable electricity by 2030. On the way to achieving that, 900 megawatts of offshore wind by 2035, 600 megawatts of distributed solar by 2025, and 6,000 and 3,000 megawatts of energy storage by 2030. And on the energy efficiency front, 185 TBTU on-site energy savings by 2025. Next slide, please. Okay, and so on that, we can sort of show a graphic of how the mix will shift from what we have today to what we need in the future. Today, we have natural gas, a fossil fuel, accounting for a little over a third. We've got coal and oil adding, accounting for somewhere around 4%. So we've got about 40% from fossil. We've got about 27% or 28% from renewables and the remainder from nuclear. And as we drive forward, we have to back down the fossil and increase the renewables. Obviously, some of the renewables that we have in place today will stay put, and we need to build additional, some of which has already been contracted. 17% of the needed future load has already been contracted by NYSERDA under some of its more significant solicitations. And we still have a meaningful bit to be contracted, about 15%, in order to hit our goals. Next slide, please. So those are the numbers, and we obviously have to hit those quantitative requirements, but there's also a very important and really new dimension to the CLCPA, which is about the equity or the equitableness of this transition. And that recognizes the need to include communities that have heretofore not participated all that meaningfully in the energy transition, to bring them onto the ship as well, and specifically to ensure that they benefit from this transition. And to that end, there's a very explicit and direct and unambiguous requirement that we need to ensure that these communities receive no less than 35%, in fact, targeting 40% of the overall benefits of spending on clean energy and energy efficiency programs, projects, and investments going forward. The nature of the spending and the nature of the benefits is still a little bit to be defined with greater precision and clarity and definition, but it includes both the benefits that flow from energy investments like carbon reduction and energy burden reduction, but also the benefits that flow from the associated investments like better housing, workforce development, pollution reduction, i.e. other than carbon, assistance in deal management, and better solutions beyond the power sector, possibly including transportation and the like, as well as economic development, so job and economic growth among those communities. And those communities can be neighborhoods, or they could be groups of people that are low income or in job categories that are facing some reductions in the workload as a result of this transition. So both numbers on the clean energy side and also equity in terms of the outcomes and the distribution of those outcomes. Next slide, please. So those are generally considerations that apply to the CLCPA broadly across all of the panels that are working on it. Power generation is one of six. With respect to power generation, our task is to develop recommendations like any other panel to make sure that we are charting the best path forward to a future electricity system that is clean and reliable and affordable and equitable. We need to achieve all four of those goals. And to dive into those four goals or attributes a little bit more, let me take you through the next four pages. So the considerations that we see in front of us, and each of these considerations you could think of as actually being a question, but for instance, how can we build on the existing approaches to invest in and site the new renewable generation that is needed to reach 70 by 30 and 100 by 40? We've got some new statutes, we've got some existing programs. What do we need to do beyond those in order to get there? How can we enhance siting, clean energy siting, to rapidly deploy and optimize the locations of the projects? How can we address the needed changes in natural gas transmission and distribution, including upstream leakage? How can we accelerate the definition of technology and identify research needs? We may not have all the solutions that are ready for prime time today. Which ones do we need by 2030 and 2040 by 50, and what can we do to accelerate those? What kind of rules do we need to set, market rules and regulatory rules, and how do we need to change those in order to support these strategies? And how can we expand the growth generally of renewable generation and energy efficiency? So those relate to a clean system. Next slide, please. We also need to be sure that we're creating or recommending a path to creating a reliable electricity and energy system. So how can we build on existing approaches to invest in the transmission / energy delivery to get the power to where it's produced and generated to where it's needed, i.e. as a customer? How can we ensure reliability during a transition from one type of generation mix to another, including the emerging recognition of we're going to need a lot more flexibility in the future, whether it comes from dispatchable generation, from storage, or from dynamic load. How can we accommodate the new peak and the new load from the waves of electrification we know are coming and should come in terms of electrifying buildings and vehicles? While we're ramping up the renewables, how can we effectively transition away from the fossil sources of electricity and energy while not compromising reliability, while not compromising safety standards, and while preserving affordability and doing everything as cost effectively as possible? How can we deploy additional resources, storage and distributed energy especially, to improve the efficiency and flexibility of the electric grid? This is kind of a systems question. And how can we improve and increase our capacity on the system for energy delivery and hosting, just being able to accommodate the new resources that we believe are going to have to show up and be invested in and deployed? So we talked about clean, we've talked about reliable. Let's talk about the next set of considerations. Next slide, please. So this is affordable. And obviously, the overriding question here is how do we do this as cost-effectively as possible, making the investments that are needed, but not making the ones that are not needed, and making them in a way and of a character that best achieves the economic that best supports the economic achievement of the goals. Part of that has to do with maximizing the market participation of different technologies. What do we want to do to make sure we have the right portfolio of generation and other machines out there in the system in the way that adds to system efficiency, so that we have the right stuff out there that we can call on and then send the correct price signals so that we in fact know how to call on it in the economically most rational way. Affordability is, you know, is basically how are we ensuring that New Yorkers have access to and can afford to participate meaningfully in our clean energy future, including all the benefits we've talked about, but also just the fundamental benefit of affordable, reliable, and of course, clean power. And generally ensuring that this affordability gets to our population at large, and that all communities, including disadvantaged communities, receive the benefits, their fair share of the benefits, 40%, a minimum of 35%, of these clean energy investments that produce cost savings and carbon reductions and jobs and other benefits and the like. And then finally, the next slide, please. You know, the fourth pillar, is equitable, and you know, obviously it pervades everything we do, and in everything we do, how are we going to make it equitable? We are going to, the clean energy transition is going to be also a clean energy jobs transition, and how do we have that jobs transition be equitable and have the workforce, the current workforce and the future workforce participate fairly in that? How do we identify and proactively advance opportunities to address health disparities in communities that host fossil fuel electric generation? It's just factual that they have some of the most severe environmental burden as a result of these facilities. So how do we address that with renewables up, flexible resources up, and fossil resources down? How do we do that swiftly and certainly, targeting specifically emissions reduction in these communities that are already overly burdened? Ensuring that the clean energy jobs transition achieves access and opportunity for all New Yorkers, with special attention to the frontline communities, which come, you know, it's not one clump of New Yorkers. There are communities that have been left out to date in what's been going on, in their communities that are facing, challenging future if they're in a job category that whose sun is setting. And then ensuring that the frontline communities have equitable access to clean energy solutions. This is another way of saying, if energy efficiency is good, make sure that everybody has a chance at good energy efficiency. If local, nearby photovoltaic solar is good, make sure that it's available to all communities. So those are the considerations that we're dealing with. You can hear that we're already wrestling with how to shape the recommendations. And this is our opportunity now to benefit from input from you on these questions. It would help us a great deal if you could offer insight on the questions you've already identified. But if you have questions we haven't identified, bring them forward too. They can only add to the usefulness and effectiveness of the recommendations that we ultimately come up with. So there's a couple more whatever guidelines for this session, and so I'm going through a timeline, I guess, before we get to that. So what we're doing, we're in the we're in sort of the gray blue chevrons that kind of run through the first half of 2021. We're an advisory panel. We've planned our work, we're developing our recommendations, and then, we're going to find out which of the recommendations are perfect just the way they are and which ones need to be adapted because some new thoughts have emerged or because we haven't really thought about how our recommendations, we haven't thought deeply enough or completely enough about how our recommendations interact with a sister panel's recommendations, say on land use or on buildings or on transportation. That's where we are. We do have some, we're in the thick of the work, as you can imagine. We need to develop our recommendations over the next no more than 2 months. And so we have some dates coming up, which we want to share with you in case they're of interest to our public attendees. On February 12th, we're going to have an advisory panel meeting that's going to talk about draft recommendations. And it's going to include an hour towards the end of that session for public input on those emerging recommendations. And then we're going to have another version of very much the same thing on the 22nd, a panel that meets and discusses the then recommendations, again with public input hour scheduled to follow. And then all of this is the chat function that's just on and available for attendees. And then on March 10th, there's a meeting to kind of have a final consideration of our final recommendations that we go. And then there's a chat that just popped up. What will then happen is that the Climate Action Council, which is actually paying attention to the work as we go and includes many, many of the folks that are on the panels, is going to consider the recommendations and sort of say, do they do what we need? Are they clear enough? Do they integrate with the other recommendations that are coming forward? Do we have reason to believe, partly because of public input that we're getting, that we need to rethink some of these things? And so they'll be vetting and rework or reprocessing of the recommendations, all in the spirit of getting to an end of the year plan that is as complete and useful and effective as possible. Next slide, please. So I've talked to you about the questions that are on our minds. I've invited you to give thoughts on those questions, but don't be constrained. Add to them if the spirit moves you. But as prompts, maybe these following kind of different kinds of questions will help you ask. So, do you understand the CLCP requirements with respect to electricity and power generation, i.e., the scope of this panel? Are there questions you have about the CLCPA and the Power Gen Advisory Panel? What do you think are the most pressing issues for the Power Gen Advisory Panel to address? You've heard us give our version, but we welcome your thoughts on those. What are your ideas about about what the state should be doing to make sure that we meet the electricity sector goals? Do you have any recommendations or recommendation topics that you'd like to see us take up, either endorsing the ones that we are or adding to them? Climate justice and equity are important CLCPA goals. What are your ideas for making sure that the CLCPA is implemented in an equitable way? What benefits would you like to see in your community, or what benefits do you think New York State should be looking to achieve? What are your thoughts on what would be a good outcome of the process, and what risks or concerns do you have about the process, and where it might not get to where we want to be? Do you have recommendations on how the panel should communicate with engage communities? And are there considerations that are impactful at a local level that you think the panel needs to consider? And I've seen a couple of things pop up, and I'm just going to answer them briefly, modeling the idea that our job is to take in your questions and input, and our panel speaking should be as limited as possible. But there's one question is, what's the definition of a frontline community? A frontline community is one, a community that is especially burdened by either the existing energy circumstances, so one that's in a community that faces an undue pollution burden compared to other communities, or one that faces an undue burden as a result not of the existing circumstances, but in the transition of circumstances. So, some of the workforces that are going to be most affected, those would meet the definition. And the other comment was nuclear. How does nuclear fit in to the 2030 goals? Nuclear is not a renewable source of generation, so the 70% has to be achieved without, and nuclear cannot be a part of that 70%. So with this, I am going to turn it over to facilitators from CADMIS who will now manage the input gathering process, which I assume will be a mixture of chats and other modes, but I'm not going to get over my skis on that. But if I could turn it over to the colleagues from CADMIS, I don't know, Gira, if that's you or anybody else. But please go forward, and maybe I'll let you go through the ground rules.
Great. Thanks so much for that introduction, Chairman Rhodes. Hello, everyone. My name is Jeremy Koo from CADMIS. I'll be helping facilitate this public comment session. Just a few ground rules here. If you are interested in speaking, please enter your name first and last in the Q&A feature of WebEx. We will be working through that and calling on you so we can keep things moving and in an orderly fashion. When you are called on, please turn on your camera and microphone and announce your name and if you're representing an organization, the name of the organization as well. Please limit your comments to 2 minutes, at most three if you're representing an organization, to comment on the work of the panel. If you are interested in commenting in greater detail beyond the 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes that are allotted, we highly recommend that you submit more detailed comments to powergenpanel@dps.newyork.gov. Those comments are passed along to the advisory panel and will be taken into consideration as part of developing the recommendations. You can also enter written comments, and we may read them aloud as we work through the list of interested commenters. All comments here will be documented as part of and included in the power generation panel's deliberations, in addition to any comments that are submitted to the email address listed here. With that in mind, I think the first person that wrote in with interest in speaking is Leonard Rodberg. Leonard, if you would feel free to turn on your camera and mic, you may comment.
Well, my mic is on. I don't know about the camera.
That's totally, if you don't have a camera, that's totally fine.
I have a camera, I just don't see a setting that would do it. So I'll be happy to be seen if there's a way to, I don't see a video control. So anyway, let me speak, I've got 2 minutes. I'm Leonard Rodberg, I'm Professor Emeritus of Urban Studies at Queens College. I have some questions for the panel. It raised questions, I have questions. One, why has the closure of Indian Point not been discussed by the panel? Closing just one unit of Indian Point last April has cost us annually more clean electricity than is generated by all the solar and wind power in the state today. At your last meeting, NYSERDA presented plans for expanding solar and wind for the next 4 years. Even if those plans are successful, they will have replaced barely one half of Indian Point's steady output with intermittent electricity. 10 years from now, we'll be right back where we were last year, burning just as much fossil fuel. Why isn't this being discussed? Number two, several studies have been presented to this panel, including by NYISO, showing that solar and wind alone cannot provide what we will need in 2040 to have a reliable, clean grid. An inadequate, unproven source, renewable natural gas, is suggested. Why isn't nuclear, which provides nearly a third of our power today and could be extended at minimal cost, suggested as a major part of the solution to this problem? Number three, New York houses one of the nation's leading sources of nuclear reactor development at the Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory in Niskayuna. Why are they and what experts like them not on this panel or consulting with it? Number four, nuclear is not a dirty word. Why is it never mentioned in these deliberations? It is our largest clean power source today. It has to be included in the panel's plans if we have any hope of finding real solutions to the climate challenge we face. Thank you for your attention. I hope you will work on some answers to these questions.
Great, thank you, Leonard. Next up, Miles McManus, if you would like to speak.
Great, can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent, thanks so much, appreciate the time. My main message for the panel is just a belief that we need to move a lot faster and avoid some of the distractions. So I'll take a couple of minutes to talk about that. The Carbon Brief article from last month, January 19th, provided an updated estimate of the remaining global carbon budget to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. And according to their estimate, that budget is currently between 230 to 440 billion tons of CO2. With that budget, we'd have to cut emissions globally almost as much as COVID did every year until we hit zero by 2040. So, this particular panel is working toward that date, which is great. And that is to have any chance at avoiding more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. But of course, that's just a probability, and there's a good chance we've already missed that window. An article yesterday in Bloomberg Green reported that sea levels are now measured to be rising faster than the most pessimistic previous forecasts. This comes from a geophysicist at the University of Copenhagen, reporting that the latest measurements mean we have to reduce the remaining carbon budget by 200 billion metric tons of carbon. So that takes a huge bite out of the timeline. But bottom line, of course, this is science. These numbers change all the time, and that's how science works. Notably, though, the timelines are not getting longer. They're getting shorter the more we learn, and science doesn't negotiate its schedule. So my message to the panel is, please move faster. It is unconscionable to take over a year for planning an approach to addressing an emergency that is already in progress. We can't afford to be talking about preserving any element of the status quo, wasting time talking about false solutions and suicidal bridges to nowhere, like using fossil fuels for reliability or burning so-called clean hydrogen, renewable natural gas, and biofuels is just ticking off precious time that we can't afford to waste. We need to be into implementation by now, so please move forward boldly and faster to protect our future. Pick up the pace. The people of New York are watching, and the world is watching us too. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Miles. Next up, I hope I got this right. Isuru Senaviratne, please feel free to unmute yourself and speak.
Hi. Hi. You can hear me, but I can't also turn on the camera.
That's fine.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Isuru Seniviratna, a Queens resident and a climate concerned citizen. I'm a graduate student of sustainability at Harvard Extension, and I've spent 16 years researching climate policy and energy investment. New York is undergoing a generational shift in electricity generation. Unfortunately, it's in the wrong direction. Evidence from NYISO's filings show that New York is causing electricity sector emissions to rise by 12 to 15 million tons per year, a 27% increase between 2019 and 2021. New York City's official filing in the DPS CES docket states, achieving the CLCPA targets requires an all-hands-on-deck approach. In New York City, in-city fuel generation provided 50 to 60% of electricity. 85 to 90% is expected to be fossil once Indian Point closes. Indian Point generated 81% of downstate carbon-free electricity in 2019 and was the largest carbon-free energy source in the state of New York. One half of this clean energy behemoth generated more carbon-free energy than all statewide wind plus solar combined. Despite the no new emissions promise Governor Cuomo made when announcing its closure, the gap is being filled by fossil fuels. Massive fracked gas plants, CPV Valley and Cricket Valley, are ramping up as we speak. Aging fossil infrastructure is being repowered at Dankskammer, Astoria Energy, and Gowanus, ensuring carbon lock-in for 30 more years. We have a few months to prevent this irreversible man-made disaster. Note, it is a man-made disaster. This plant is fully operational and permitted to operate for another 4 years. Rather than succumb to the shale economics and special interest pressure, the Climate Action Council, and specifically the Power Generation Advisory Panel, could go beyond what's politically popular and implore the governor to prevent Indian Point's closure. The largest greenhouse gas increase in the history of New York is likely happening on your watch. If you won't even acknowledge it, how will you fix it? Thank you.
Great, thank you. Next up we have Roger Kayatsa.
Oh my God.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Roger.
My name is Roger Kayatsa.
Yes, please feel free.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
My name is Roger Kayatsa. My name is Roger Kayatsa. Thank you for pronouncing it right. I'm a retired air pollution meteorologist making personal comments representing my fixed income senior citizen demographic. I do not believe that the majority of New York citizens have any idea what the Climate Act means to their future, but I do, and the potential impacts on affordability and reliability of the electric system scare me. The German green energies experience should be an affordability concern. Germany's electricity prices have increased 27% for the past decade, and green energy surcharges make up half the cost. Their targets are less aggressive than ours, so I suspect our costs will increase more. When the Climate Action Council claims that the plans are cost-effective, even with increased costs, because of the New York value of carbon, should be recognized that today's real costs are only cheaper compared to contrived, value-driven estimates of speculative impacts occurring out to 2300, almost exclusively out of the state. I'm uncomfortable listening to the panel when reliability concerns are raised. There seems to be little recognition that there will always be peak electric energy periods. When it's very hot or very cold, society needs more energy. The point is that you need to design the electric system to address those periods, not hope that a magical solution will eliminate peak loads. Failure to do so will mean reliability risk at the worst possible time. As a meteorologist, I worry that an assessment of renewable energy resources using observed meteorological data has not been prepared. It is critical to determine how much renewable energy is available in the multi-day winter doldrums, because energy use will increase in the future due to heating and transportation electrification. The bottom line is that energy use is inelastic, and increase in energy costs is a regressive expense. While it is entirely appropriate, there should be an emphasis on environmental and social justice. Your proposed strategies have to consider cost effectiveness to reduce the regressive impact on those who can least afford those increased costs, regardless of location, or living in energy poverty, or have a disproportionate energy burden. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Roger. Next up, we have Keith Hsu.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I also don't see a screen, but I guess that's okay. Yeah, my name is Keith Hsu. I'm an environmentalist. I'm also an electrical engineer who understands the practical aspects of making things work in the real world. I am extremely concerned that the CLCPA will fail, that you will not succeed in decarbonizing the grid, because nobody on your panel is talking about what produces half of our carbon-free electricity today and a third of our electricity in New York, nuclear power. Indian Point produces zero emissions. The decision to shut down half of it last year was a decision to keep dirty fossil fuel power plants within EJ communities of New York City running instead. And at almost the exact same time, we took out 1,000 megawatts of carbon-free baseload electricity, another 1,000 megawatts of gas fired up at the giant new Cricket Valley plant in Dover. Nuclear went down, gas went up. We have 8 months of real-time data from NYISO to prove it. I'm going to submit that for the record, by the way. Renewables and efficiency did not replace Indian Point. Gas did. Look, the most unjust transition is the one that does not happen. It is time to tell the truth. In the CLCPA's first year, we took a big step backwards. I support wind and solar, and batteries can help eliminate peaker plants, but those things alone will not replace baseload electricity. It's not just political will, it's physics, energy density, intermittency transmission. And unless you discover how to grow a tree as fast as it burns, biomass is not a net zero answer either. Mark my word, if we lose nuclear power in New York, Cricket Valley will still be here in 2040, and it won't be burning hydrogen or renewable natural gas, which is the Kool-Aid that the gas industry wants you to drink. It'll be burning fracked gas from Pennsylvania. On pollution, on carbon emissions, land use, materials, waste containment, and safety, nuclear actually has the least impact of all energy sources. And all of the viable paths identified by the IPCC urgency for attaining climate targets involve the continuation or the expansion of nuclear power. So you can listen to outdated anti-nuclear ideology and fear-mongering, where we can recognize the critical role that existing and advanced nuclear power must play if we hope to tackle climate change and meet energy needs of the world. Please put experts on your committee who understand, appreciate, and are willing to talk about the value of nuclear power and make nuclear power part of your plan. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Keith. Next up will be Kyle Rabin, and followed by Dennis Higgins. So, Kyle, if you'd like to unmute.
Thank you. Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. So I'm speaking on behalf of the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. And first, I just want to thank the panel members and state staff for an incredible investment of time into this process. East New York will be submitting more detailed comments to the advisory panel, but I just wanted to highlight a few brief priorities here. It is not an oversimplification to say that the most important immediate action for the state of New York to take is to ensure that wind and solar projects break ground and get built. This is how we begin to make measurable progress towards the 70% goal. This is how we will also make progress towards the goal for transportation and buildings, as we will be relying on electrifying these uses with clean, renewable electricity. Renewable project developers need several project components to get projects built. They need a long-term contract, an interconnection agreement, a permit, and a tax agreement. We appreciate that the state has made excellent progress on contracting, and we urge the state to stay the course on its procurement schedule. The New York State ISO has been striving to make the interconnection process timelier, with some success, but there needs to be a continuing focus on that. The new permitting regime is an important step, and we urge the state to stay on schedule for finalizing those permitting regulations by April 1st. There's also a need for New York State to publish a standard method for assessing property taxes on wind and solar projects to provide guidance to municipalities. We hope that can be established in law as soon as possible. Beyond those immediate needs, New York needs transmission. We applaud New York's recent efforts on transmission and urge the state to continue to be ambitious and creative on ways to achieve the transmission investments we need on the schedule they are needed. We support an all-of-the-above strategy on getting transmission built, approving the utilities' identified local system upgrades, pursuing priority transmission projects via New York Power Authority, and declaring public policy needs related to the climate law in the public policy transmission needs process under FERC Order 1000. We also support New York State identifying renewable energy zones where strategic investments in transmission infrastructure could open new areas to project proposals upstate or provide collector stations for offshore wind. In short, ACE supports a variety of measures to help ensure renewable energy projects can get built and the pollution-free power they produce can be delivered. There are other important actions that can support this work in the pursuit of equity and cost effectiveness. This would include, for example, continuing to invest in distributed renewables, especially in the low and moderate income sector, offering financial incentives to communities that host renewables, and supporting carbon pricing in the wholesale electricity market so that the market is aligned with the clean electricity goals. Lastly, a word on achieving 100% by 2040. The primary focus of the CAC scoping plan with respect to power generation for the years 2021 through at least 2030 should be facilitating the construction of renewable electricity facilities and simply getting projects built. The actions to pursue during this same time frame should be: one, that we need to clearly define emissions-free in regulation to inform how New York State will achieve the 2040 goals. Also, we need to study Great Lakes wind power potential. This involves the completion of a feasibility study regarding offshore wind development in the Great Lakes. We also need to keep the renewables we have, and that means refining New York State's policies regarding the repowering of existing renewable energy projects to ensure continued investment in and operation of these facilities, especially to increase generation. Also, New York has a new program for existing renewables, but it ends in 3 years. We think we should use this time to develop a permanent solution for maintaining renewables as they come off contracts. And then finally, we need to continue the last 100% analysis and research and development. The ISO modeling of 100% emissions free in 2040 identifies the challenge of achieving the final percentage of renewable energy at those limited but critical times of peak demand and low wind and solar generation. To plan for 2040, New York State and the ISO should continue this analysis and attempt to identify what the percentage is at both likely and optimal levels of transmission, storage, and renewables. Further, New York State should assess, research, and define what dispatchable emissions-free resources would be most able to meet this last percentage. We are a long way from reaching this last percent, but we should research solutions for that last percentage starting now. Thank you again for the opportunity to present our initial thoughts.
Great. Thank you, Kyle. Next up, Dennis Higgins, and then followed by Paul Van Lindenthal. So Dennis, if you would like to speak up.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Dennis Higgins. I was a professor of mathematics and computer science at the New York State University System until I retired recently. Determining how best to generate power to meet CLCPA goals is critical. Due to the premature Indian Point closure, New York will generate tens of millions more tons of CO2e from the electricity sector in 2021 than we did in 2019. We'll need to run big new gas power plants at Cricket Valley and CPV, and we'll need to keep burning fossil fuels in old power plants in Metro New York. Environmental justice issues are a priority for CLCPA, but we see that new environmental justice communities have been created, and existing ones in Metro New York have been singularly targeted in year one of the CLCPA. Vermont, California, Germany, and of course New York itself show that promises to replace nuclear power with renewables have been disingenuous at best. Gas combustion has replaced lost nuclear generation in those places. While France has clean air and cheap nuclear energy, Germany is burning coal and wood and wants to import US LNG and build a pipeline to Russia. Wind and solar, even combined with gigantic batteries, will not power Staten Island or Brooklyn. If charged, the proposed Ravenswood 2.5 gigawatt hour battery, which would be the world's largest, wouldn't provide 15 minutes worth of New York City's energy needs. Wind turbines and solar panels must be overbuilt to compensate for intermittency and low power density. One speaker tonight mentioned energy costs. As we've seen in California, ratepayers are fleeced as solar energy is dumped during the day, but gas plants power up at night. However much wind and solar are deployed, research indicates that a large part of the energy portfolio must be baseload or dispatchable power. NYISO has also spoken to this issue to CAC. A smart path forward would be to recognize that we need to preserve New York's existing fleet of safe, energy-dense nuclear reactors. To avert climate catastrophe, we will need to invest in a new generation of nuclear reactors. Gas companies support calls for 100% renewables. They know gas is frequently partnered with wind and solar, and so have proposed over 5,000 megawatts of new or repowered gas plants for New York. To get New York out of the hole it has dug on its climate goals, you will need to make nuclear power a part of the state's plan. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dennis. Next up, Paul Van Lindenthal, followed by Adam Flint.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Paul Van Lindenthal, retired librarian from Brooklyn. I believe nuclear power will be needed to fight climate change and ocean acidification in New York, the United States, and the larger world as well. I have therefore the following concerns for the panel. The composition of the CAC panel seems to be mainly consist of people with preferences either towards renewable or the fossil industry. There's no nuclear energy representative, as far as I know. The documents filed by NYISO show that 5,000 megawatts of new or repowered glass panels are currently proposed despite the passage of the CLCPA. The environmental justice, consequently, the environmental justice neighborhoods near mine, Gowanus, Astoria, and Ravenswood, will singularly be targeted by the increase in combustion. So far, the panel has not adequately addressed the drawbacks of renewable energy, such as intermittency, non-dispatchability, failure of adequate storage, overbuilding, all costs which will increase the cost to the ratepayer. The panel also failed to address a plan or a study plan for the so-called firm energy needed to back up the renewables. Multiple presentations to the CAC, including NYISO, have stressed that even if renewable and efficient targets are met, we still will have not sufficient firm capacity. Firm refers to the energy that could be supplied by gas, hydro, or nuclear. Hydro potential is limited, so how will the panel deal with that? More gas? That's the question. The panel does not show any awareness of the national and international use of renewable energy. Both California and Germany, as mentioned before, have shut down their nuclear reactors and deployed wind and solar sources 6 times the capacity of New York's. Yet compared to the neighboring economies, they have higher utility costs, brownouts, higher greenhouse gas emission and particulate emission. The power generation panel and the CAC in general are not showing to be knowledgeable about nuclear energy and have avoided mentioning the consequences of closing Indian Point, nor considered any way of keeping Indian Point open. And instead, the panel ignored nuclear power as an important source for carbon-free energy, which supplies half the emission-free in state and half this emission free emission energy in the state and a third of New York's total energy portfolio. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Next up is Adam Flint, followed by Dietmar Dettering, after which we'll read a comment that was written in chat by Keith Rodan.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Adam Flint, and I represent the Network for a Sustainable Tomorrow based in Binghamton, New York. And I have some comments that are very specific to the CLCPA's mandate to prioritize low and moderate income communities and communities of color in terms of benefit from renewable energy. Basically, these fall into three areas. The first is benefit. The second is project economics, and the third is process cost reduction. I'm also going to weave in a little bit of workforce development there and try to be really quick here. As far as benefit, I guess the main issues that we see in getting folks onto community shared solar is that there's a lack of projects, and the discount that is available on average is 5 to 10%. Including perhaps 15 New York Solar for All project or Solar for All program. The evidence we've seen from other states is that 20% is pretty much the rock bottom to really incentivize low income subscribers, customers to join. And it's better to go higher than that. The DC Solar for All program is 50% off. Second, making community ownership and control easier. NYSERDA has a pre-development fund, which is a step up from the first iteration, but there are still very significant costs that have money has to be found for, and there's not provisions to deal with that. Moving on to project economics, in order to be able to deliver a higher benefit for community solar, and also in order to make the jobs that are created in the solar sector more lucrative, the value stack is going to have to be thicker. There's going to have to be more value in the stack. And I know this flies in the face of what the Public Service Commission has done over the last 5 years, but I feel, and many of us feel, that that was a bad course to take. There's also a LMI adder program that NYSERDA has rolled out. There's a lot of stakeholder comments that are coming in for the RFI. but a lot of them are along the lines of more incentives are needed. If you compare New Jersey and Illinois, for example, developers are finding that those markets are much more conducive to being able to make projects pencil and deliver value. In terms of process cost reduction, there's an incipient process underway in Massachusetts whereby utilities and the state work together to find sites that have the right characteristics to build projects, and the upgrades are actually done apart from the projects. If a project is built, the project developer is paying a percentage of that, but part of that is going to be paid through rates. And I think the last thing I'll say, sort of in reflection of some of the comments about affordability, I will also speak very strongly in favor of the CCIA as a means of getting money into the system to be able to pay for all of this. I agree that absent other money, we're going to have a problem. I would also very, very strongly encourage the agencies that are participating in the CLCPA process to be extremely engaged in Washington through government affairs and through the governor's office. As everyone knows, our senator is now the majority leader in Congress. I think last night or the night before, he spoke very strongly in favor of this transition and specifically of environmental justice as a pillar of that. And we know that the governor has a close relationship with our new president. I think New York is very well positioned to get funding through infrastructure and through standalone bills and should be very aggressive in doing so. Thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you, Adam. Next will be Dietmar Dessering, after which I will read a comment on behalf of Keith Rodin, and then will be followed by Richard Berkeley. So Dietmar, after you.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Dietmar Dessering. I'm an environmentalist and I live with my family in Queens. Thank you for your work on implementing the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. I fully support the goal of 100% clean electricity by 2040, but I sense that New York is making some mistakes trying to get there. Let's learn from Germany and California. Full disclosure, I'm German, so I know a little bit. Solar, wind, transmission, and storage failed to significantly reduce emissions. Why? Because they're both shut down safe, reliable, energy-dense nuclear reactors. Tragically, New York seems intent on repeating their mistakes and is already burning more gas. After last year's shutdown of Indian Point 2, fracked gas replaced nuclear generation. Indian Point 3's shutdown is scheduled for this April, triggering more gas and oil combustion, much of it at older plants in environmental justice communities right here in Queens. In 2019, Indian Point units 1, 2, and 3 generated 2.5 times the electricity of all solar and wind in the state. Rescuing Indian Point's 2 gigawatt of clean, reliable generation could do as much, if not more, to displace fossil fuel electricity generation as magically multiplying all the state's existing wind and solar by 3.5 times right now and at minimal cost. And all this energy would feed the downstate grid, where our energy transition challenges are most serious. Saving Indian Point would be the cheapest and fastest way for New York to protect climate and environmental justice communities. So far, however, the Climate Action Council and this panel have excluded nuclear energy experts. They have also avoided discussing the environmental and public health disaster of prematurely shutting down Indian Point. I'm now calling on Chair John Rhodes to put the important 100% carbon-free and clean energy goal by 2040 into the center of the debate now and include nuclear energy in the discussion. Preserving our current fleet of reactors is critical to state goals and is the best recommendation this panel can make. Nuclear energy, including new construction, will need to be part of the solution, and we have to talk about it now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dietmar. I'm going to read a comment on behalf of Keith Rodin, who is not able to access the microphone. So Keith's comment, shutting down and then demolishing Indian Point, which is a well-built and long-lasting facility, is an incredible waste as it is unconscionable. Not only is it an environmental waste by depriving New York City of nearly 30% of its reliable carbon-free electricity, but a financial waste in that the cost of decommissioning and demolition runs into millions of taxpayers' dollars, and the citizens will also foot the bill for the multitude of windmills and solar farms that Governor Cuomo intends to build to supply the energy that was formerly from Indian Point. These have been shown to be intermittent, short-lived, and environmentally hazardous, both to animal life, but more especially the carbon footprint in materials, assembly, and eventual decommissioning and recycling. The governor's plan to replace Indian Point has been studied by scientists and engineers and is shown to be inaccurate. The needed power will, they say, be backed up by gas generator plants and will... I think that's the end of the comment as written in the chat. Next up, Richard Berkeley, and then Ethan Bodnaruk.
Thank you, and I don't see an ability to turn on my camera just as well. I'm working on my beard, for those of you who don't know me. My name is Richard Berkeley. I am the director of the Public Utility Law Project of New York. We're a consumer organization. We act in the area of public utilities, and we represent low and fixed income New Yorkers, but I am not here in that role tonight. I'm here as a citizen of the state of my birth. So very simply, I want to start by saying thank you to Chair Rhodes and to the members of this advisory panel for the huge amount of time that you put into this. And I respect your service on this. It is an incredibly difficult transition. It is probably the hardest pivot in New York's economy in our entire history. The only thing that comes close is the Erie Canal, which of course us upstaters like to talk about, and the birth of New York City. We're doing something that we've never tried before, but it is vitally important. There is no plan B for the planet. And so I think that's important to mention. It's also important to talk about the fact that up until this moment in time, energy in New York has been largely unaffordable for a significant portion of the population. Yes, I say this in my work life and will provide more technical comments subsequently on paper in that role. But as an individual, I think it's important to mention that while this panel and the CLCPA generally begin changing our economy, they have to not only vow not to forget low-income and moderate-income consumers in New York and seniors, but they also have to put that first, because we can't make this transition by saying we'll get back to those groups later. Similarly, we can't make this transition by saying we'll get transitions later. That has to come first, and it has to be part of every analysis. When we talk about backing down power plants in one part of the state or another, that has to be accompanied by plans for jobs. If tax money is lost for that municipality, and as we all know, most of the municipals in upstate New York have financial difficulties, then that has to be part of the plan. There has to be, as you all know, an assessment of how does the state triage where it's going to act first, get the quickest return on its investment so that can be recycled in other parts of places of the state. And again, I won't get into any technical discussions now because that's better on paper. But I just want to say thank you for the effort that you have put into this. Thank you for listening as you're doing now. And please continue to make this as public and accountable as possible. Thus, I urge that this type of presentation or subsequent ones be done in all of the primary spoken languages in the state of New York, and that advertising also be done in the other primary spoken and written languages in the state of New York. Language access is an important part of our state's rights and goals, and this process, which will change the state for everyone, also needs to be accessible in that kind of manner. So thank you for this opportunity to speak tonight, and thank you to all the public who are coming up to talk and weigh in on this important issue.
Great, thank you, Richard. Next up, Ethan Bodnaruk, followed by Sarah Wukerson. Ethan?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. My name is Ethan Bodnarik. I'm a licensed professional engineer in water resources and live in the Ithaca area. I really appreciate the work of this panel, the CLCPA, and its focus on environmental justice. These past 4 years under Trump have showed the destructive power of misplaced fear and misinformation. Here in New York State and across the country, I'm concerned that misplaced fear and misinformation are holding us back from more effective climate action. The scientific literature consistently identifies expanded nuclear power as a key component of addressing climate change. Despite a continual focus on fear in the media, nuclear is already one of the safest energy sources there is, and advanced reactors are orders of magnitude safer. It seems like New York has pretty solid plans to increase renewables. As they increase, there will be more variability in the system, and it will be more and more important to have carbon-free baseload energy. This is also key to closing baseload fossil fuel plants. I hope that the CAC considers the important role of nuclear in meeting the 2040 goals, including reducing emissions in dense urban centers, its small land footprint, and multiple studies, including from MIT and Princeton, that show that zero carbon electricity costs are lower with nuclear. I'm concerned that in the CAC consultants' report on decarbonization for New York, that it doesn't mention nuclear, where the very same consultants' reports for other states like Washington and Illinois do recognize the important benefits of nuclear. One practical ask is for the committee to urgently pursue carbon pricing with environmental justice provisions, because this will help support all zero carbon sources, as well as energy storage and carbon neutral fuels. We need all these different approaches. So I ask that you please do not arbitrarily exclude nuclear from your committee's work, and pursue policies and actions that will support a diverse mix of carbon-free energy sources capable of meeting the demands of New York residents and businesses in a cost-effective, just, and climate-protecting way. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ethan. Next up, Sarah Wukeson, followed by Eric Dawson.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, I'm Sarah Wilkerson. I'm a member of the public, and I have a question. It's for everybody, but I guess especially John Rhodes. So I live in East Williamsburg, about a 10-minute walk from the National Grid facility along Newton Creek, which is notably already a Superfund site, i.e. a frontline community. And National Grid is in the process of building the North Brooklyn Pipeline, which is eventually going to go right through my neighborhood. It's going to go to that facility. They're going to liquefy natural gas there, and then they're going to truck it back out right through my community and the surrounding communities. I see this as a direct threat to my personal safety as well as the environment as a whole. And I just want to understand how you could possibly reconcile this with the stated goals of the Climate Community Protection Act. I'm done.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah. I don't know if any of the panelists would like to respond to that.
It could just be a comment, if not.
Chairman Rhodes, it looks like you're speaking, but you are on mute.
Can folks hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the question. Obviously, it's an important one. that North Brooklyn project that you're talking about is a topic that's potentially up for decision by my commission. There are rules that say I can't comment on it, but it's probably coming in front of us. And I understand your concerns.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Rhodes. We'll move on to a comment from Eric Dawson, followed by Irene Weiser. Eric, are you able to unmute yourself? Eric, I see you're unmuted, but I am not able to hear you. I see you're muting and unmuting yourself. If your mic is not working, if you would like to enter your comment into the chat, I'm happy to read it out on your behalf. We'll move on to Irene Weiser, followed by David Gower.
Hi, thanks for this meeting tonight. I'm Irene Weiser from Fossil Free Tompkins in Tompkins County. I had earlier, I guess at this point it was last year in November, written some comments to this committee along with the Energy Intensive and Trade Exposed Industries Committee. To talk about some concerns I have with behind-the-meter generation using gas. And it presents a situation that I think becomes an end run around the CLCPA greenhouse gas emission goals. And so I wanted to be sure that that has come to the committee's attention. I think that it started with the Greenwich power plant on Seneca Lake that was granted a certificate of public convenience and necessity to switch from being a gas and wood burning power plant to running a data center behind the meter. And this allows them to skirt through a lot of the CLCPA greenhouse gas reduction goals. It's certainly a concern for us in upstate New York, but I think it becomes an even larger concern when I look at the NOx regulations for the very polluting plants downstate in environmental justice communities, because the NOx regulations would also allow for the same behind the meter type of switch, you know, end run switch that would allow them to have some sort of industrial use behind the meter and to continue to burn polluting fuels for many years to come. So I really, really urge the committee to look at this. I don't know if it's something that should be addressed through the CLCPA and the committee recommendations directly or a legislative fix or quite what is need, what's needed to address it. I'd also add that it's raised the issue more broadly for me of how behind the meter is being addressed for the use of any kind of combined heat and power. NYSERDA has long promoted combined heat and power for microgrid development. I know of commercial buildings that are looking to go to combined heat and power as a way to reduce their greenhouse emissions, and that the generation of 25 megawatts and below were not being counted in the way that our emissions were being evaluated. So I'm very concerned that behind the meter poses a lot of threats and ways to continue to use gas in this state, including in environmental justice communities, including in buildings that really should be converting to heat pumps. And we need to have a fix to this end run. I honestly was at a loss to come up with recommendations. I have some ideas, but I figured that's the panel's responsibility. But if there need to be a legislative fix or something else, I'd ask that people get in touch with me. And I'd be happy to work on other directions to pursue this. But it really is somewhat of a loophole that needs to be closed. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Irene. Next up, David Gower, followed by Pramila Malik.
Okay, thank you. This is David Gower, also from the Ithaca area. Thanks for the opportunity to chat here. I'm a graduate of a master's program at Clarkson University in Environmental Science and Engineering. Also work for a community solar developer. It's also dealing with some energy storage projects. So, but the other thing I've spent a lot of time looking at is community choice aggregation and community distributed generation programs. Also, community solar is what people think of the most in that. And I see an amazing opportunity to bring these programs together and achieve some of the things that a lot of folks have talked about. And so unlike criticism, I'm actually going to make a suggestion here, and I'd love to talk about it more in depth in just a few seconds. But by combining community choice aggregation, which allows bulk buying on behalf of the whole community, you by design are able to include everybody in that community. So equity becomes no longer an issue. And combining that with community solar and taking out some of the intermediaries that are there or supporting communities to be their own CDG sponsor and CCA administrator means that they're able to, on their own behalf, bring their entire community into the program. Now, currently, allocations are usually based on a single meter, and so you end up having those that are savvy about community solar most likely to sign up and get that 10% discount. But if they could spread that out amongst the whole community, maybe it's a smaller percentage for that first project, but the towns can also get subscription money from the community members they're bringing to it and hopefully build the next project. I'd love to go deeper on that. I've written a paper and I welcome the opportunity to talk more. And just with a few last seconds here, just given the fact that the nuclear lobby seems to be well represented here, I just need to say my two cents on that. You know, I think we must all have a short memory about the dangers of nuclear. So let's not forget Chernobyl. Let's not forget Three Mile Island. And of course, Fukushima. And let's not forget that Indian Point was built in the 60s and has had 14 incidents over its time period, two of which were in the 70s and the 80s, and 12 of which were all from 2000 forward. So I think at some point we have to recognize nuclear is not renewable because its waste will last generations and generations. So we do need to make the turn. It will be an investment for sure, but at the end of the day, with the cost and the difficulties and timing and the environmental destruction that nuclear can cause, I'm very happy that there's been a commitment to sticking to renewables and non-fossil fuel moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Next up will be Pramila Malik, followed by Carl Perez.
Hi, sorry about that. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm going to be speaking extemporaneously because I just found out about this meeting. So I apologize if I repeat myself or such. But my name is Pramila Malik. I'm the chair of Protect Orange County. Our organization represents over 300,000 residents of Orange County that are now frontline communities, victims of failure of public policy to protect the public interest and to protect public health by allowing the development of the CPV Valley frack gas power plant that was specifically built to replace carbon-free Indian Point. So I want to start out by A, concurring with those who talk about the carbon, the climate benefits of nuclear power. And I think, you know, the previous speaker spoke about risk. I think the fact that Indian Point has been operating since the 1960s without a major incident is actually reassuring to me versus replacing it with new and very dangerous and unknown fracked gas. Fracked gas is a relatively new technology. We don't fully understand the climate impacts. We don't fully understand the public health impacts. My organization was one of the first to document health impacts from interstate gas infrastructure in the country. And since that time, the data that we've been compiling is even more alarming. We have, you know, Orange County is an agricultural district, and the area where that plant was sited is surrounded by 14, not one, not two, 14 environmental justice communities, and the plant was permitted in violation of our environmental justice protection laws. That said, however, we are an agricultural community. The plant was sited in the middle of the valley. So all those emissions are really just hovering right in Orange County, which is the food belt of New York State. And I think when you look at all of the impacts of climate change, you have to factor that in, that we are the food belt. So is it really wise to have carbon-free nuclear power being replaced by frack gas and destroying not only environment, you know, the health of environmental justice communities, but also our precious agricultural areas and our precious agricultural soil. Orange County is the, you know, the soil in Orange County is the official soil of the state of New York. The other thing I want to say is that the only metric that should really matter to your commission is carbon. And not only carbon, but the global warming impact. When you talk about replacing carbon-free nuclear power with frack gas, frack gas is methane. And although methane burns cleaner than, say, coal, and by the way, there's very little coal. We all know there's no coal really being burnt in New York State anymore, or minimal, maybe 1% to 2%, if that. So what it's really replacing is carbon-free nuclear power. But when we look at fracked gas, we have to look at the global warming impact of methane, which is 100 times greater than carbon from burning methane, from CO2. And the reason I say that is because we have documented large amounts of emissions of fugitive methane, both at the infrastructure to serve the power plant as well as at the power plant itself. We've had spikes of emissions of particulate matter in the 200 ranges, in the 300 ranges. There's constant venting. All of this needs to be really looked at and calculated and addressed by this commission. And I don't think anyone is really looking at the full public health and climate impact of our use of methane. So I think that the number one task, if we're really serious about climate change, is to shut down frack gas facilities first. And here I say, it's not one or the other. It's not, you know, nuclear versus renewable, or nuclear versus wind, or wind versus, you know, energy efficiency or frack gas. We should eliminate energy power generation facilities in order of their carbon impact, of their global warming impact. And if we were to use that metric, then the very first thing we should be doing is shutting down all fracked gas facilities, all gas facilities first, and then replacing, and then shutting down nuclear. And I've always said that if tomorrow the climate science were to say nuclear is worse than gas, I would be the first one to accept that and live with those consequences, but that's not what the science is saying. So I think that, you know, we should build the renewable first, you know, wind, solar, whatever we can, and then shut down facilities in order of their carbon impact. And then once we have the renewable energy and the energy efficiency in place, then we can shut down nuclear power if people still believe it to be an existential threat. The other suggestion I have is the development of onshore wind in upstate New York. I think there was at one point 8,000 megawatts of wind power available in the NYISO queue. But in order for that to really be viable, there has to be a transmission line built from upstate New York to the downstate power market. The final comment actually is a question, is I would like to know exactly what the role of the council is in addressing the compliance of specific power generation facilities with the CCPLA.
Hey, thank you, Pramila. Next, we're going to move on to Carl Perez, followed by, it seems like Eric Dawson has gotten his mic working again. Just a couple quick reminders. If you would like to speak, this is at the end of the list of folks who have indicated their name. Please do write in your name first and last in the Q&A if you are interested in speaking. And also, please do keep your comments to up to 2 minutes and up to three if you are representing an organization. With that, over to you, Carl.
Yes, hello, and my name is Carl Perez, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Elysium Industries, which is an advanced nuclear developer based here in New York. One thing I just want to emphasize is New York State actually has the best nuclear power plant designers in the world. They just happen to work for the Navy at the Knowles Atomic Power Lab in upstate New York, but they design everything at cost and on time. And there's a lot of promise in the field of nuclear innovation, and I think one of the areas to start is allowing NYSERDA to actually fund some of the R&D in that area as opposed to having a moratorium on nuclear. And I think that would help in informing NYSERDA and the rest of the administration on how nuclear can actually be very beneficial in the future, specifically technologies that can't melt down to, of course, accommodate the many anti-nuclear arguments that are currently being used. Although it's true that shutting off Indian Point's two units actually caused more deaths, or at least premature deaths, than the civil nuclear industry in its entirety. But again, we must understand the fears of the people that will be living in these areas. I was actually anti-nuclear, and the only reason why I started looking at nuclear in the first place was because of the materials throughput, the amount of energy invested relative to the amount of energy returned. I think these are metrics that should be weighed into the calculation. There are proven waste consumption methods and burning methods, including one that we've developed with the Department of Energy in 2017. So I think there's a lot there to, again, better inform the New York Climate Action Council on what could be done. But again, all this really comes from just living in Manhattan, seeing natural gas plants providing our power. We lost 80% of our clean electricity with Indian Point. We could actually reuse the nuclear waste at Indian Point. So again, my apologies if I've run over the time. Some of the Climate Action Council members know me. I'm more than happy to help in any capacity in terms of information provision. But thank you for taking our comments in the first place.
Great, thank you, Carl. So Eric Dawson, if you would like to try speaking again, after which we'll go to Michelle Rogat.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right, so it's a miracle. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I'm a pro-nuclear environmentalist, like many of the people who have joined us tonight, so I'll try to make this quick. Basically, there is a major problem with panels like these, and that is also carried on in the public energy debate and the resulting legislation, and that is that it's framed as a binary: clean renewable versus dirty fossil, renewable versus fossil. But energy policy, like many other things, is actually non-binary. And there's a third option, which is also carbon-free, and that is nuclear energy. There is no reason for religious devotion to any particular technology. We should simply do what works, and nuclear actually works. In the real world of millions of people living nearly century-long lifespans in modern first-world countries, we cannot simply ban fossil fuels. We cannot wish them away. Instead, we must displace fossil fuels through substitution. And nuclear is actually the best of both worlds. It has the reliability and efficiency of fossil fuels, but the absence of air pollution and absence of carbon emissions of renewables. It's carbon-free. Other less obvious environmentalist concerns are it has the lowest land use intensity and the lowest material intensity. I encourage everybody to look those up, land use and material intensity. But really, the worst part of renewables compared to nuclear are their intermittence. And we ultimately are fragilizing our electric grid by increasing intermittent energy sources. Something will be needed to compensate, and that something is fossil fuels. In New York State, ultimately, more intermittent wind and solar means more baseload natural gas. And every major study of phasing out nuclear power has resulted in increased carbon emissions. For this very reason, I encourage everybody to look up Germany as the case study of this. And you can compare it to many other rich countries that have clean air, such as France, Finland, Sweden, Switzerland, many others that rely heavily on nuclear. And I find that the objections to nuclear are weak if you consider the totality of evidence. There's ultimately a low risk of meltdown. Nuclear power has been used for over 60 years. We have 400 power plants in over 30 countries around the world. There have only been three major accidents. Two of them resulted in zero deaths. The only tragic one was Chernobyl, but that was more of an indictment of the Soviet system, not the technology itself. And there's ultimately a low risk of any problems with nuclear storage. Nuclear storage is kept in, you know, thick concrete casts above ground. In the future, most could be moved underneath the surface. All nuclear waste that's ever been created in the U.S. could fit inside a football field. It might seem big, but consider how big our country is. It's actually very small. And nuclear energy is the only energy required to account for all of its waste by the Department of Energy. That's the only source that has that requirement. And I'm trying to be quick, but one thing that I would encourage everybody to look up on the internet is deaths per kilowatt by energy source. If you just do a quick image search for deaths by energy, this will come up. Nuclear is superior in terms of deaths per electricity unit. This is the graph that really matters. And it proves that nuclear has saved infinitely more lives than it has taken. Nuclear saves lives. There's three functioning plants, nuclear plants in upstate New York and downstate. We only have Indian Point, and this is why I think we should keep IP3 open. It is scheduled to close April 30th in just a couple months. If global warming and climate change are emergencies, if air pollution is an emergency, if COVID-19 is an emergency, well, then New York State, as a government, should keep nuclear plants like Indian Point open based on these emergencies. So the CLCPA should embrace nuclear energy because nuclear energy saves lives. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Michelle Rogat, after which it does not seem that anyone else has is interested in speaking, but if you are, please do write in your name in the Q&A now.
All right, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, I'm Michelle Rogan. I live up in Troy, New York, up in the Capital Region. I am getting my master's degree in urban and regional planning with a focus on sustainability from SUNY Albany. My research paper for my thesis right now is focusing on the role of local government and regional planning on energy and sustainability. And maybe it is just that I have fresh student eyes on this, but I have noticed that the only regional planning organizations that actually get federal and state funding in New York State seem to be MPOs, and they are focused solely on transportation. So I have been paying attention to these proceedings and have been paying attention to proceedings for a few years now, and I still haven't seen any talks about regional energy planning in New York State, and New York State seems to be very poised to be able to do this because New York State has its own independent system operator solely for New York State. And so it really seems that a regional planning effort that was built between NYISO, the utilities, local governments, and then regional planning organizations that included the local governments would be really, really helpful. And I know that this has occurred in other states. I also am currently on Capital District Community Energy, which is a nonprofit steering committee organization that was helping the regional municipalities up here kind of navigate and figure out CCA, Community Choice Aggregation. And I do want to say, through my experience through that, another key point of this is that it does tend to be like a binary conversation, or just the conversation in the public and even among municipal leaders and planners, is the big issue and barrier here is a lack of understanding and education around energy in general. And that is a major barrier that our whole society is going to have to deal with. And lastly, I want to say I have experience previously working at a affordable housing nonprofit that helped the LMI community navigate NYSERDA's programs. And I do want to say that while those programs are very great, a suggestion for helping with affordability and equity here would be if NYSERDA put more funding towards the capacity of these programs in helping the LMI community. The Capital Region right now has one clean energy advisor for the 8 counties that she has to work with to get their applications approved to go through those programs. And that is not a single situation just with the Capital Region. It seems to be that each of those advisors have to deal with either from four to about 10 or 12 counties each. And we could really use more of those key people. And so that's all I have to say for now. I do want to thank you for your good work, and I look forward to hear what comes out of this.
Thank you, Michelle. Looks like Brian Campbell would like to speak.
Yes, my name is Brian Campbell. I would like to say I sent you to the electricitymap.org. This is live emissions throughout the world. You can compare live right now what Ontario is. It's about 62 grams per kilowatt hour. Compare that to New York, which is brown. Or look at France, which is even better. But the reason why they are better, the reason why they are low carbon, is because they have a large percentage of their electrical generation by nuclear power. That is, if you look at all over the world, anywhere that is green, it either has a high percentage of nuclear power or hydro or a combination of the two. And New York could do the same. We could build more nuclear power plants. To shut down Indian Point atomic power is, and 2 megawatts of clean power just gone. 80% of New York City's clean power unplugged. You're not going to replace that with intermittent wind. You're not going to replace it with intermittent solar. And the amount of those renewables to make up for Indian Point nuclear is more than is installed in all the state, including what it gets from Niagara Falls. So this is just a travesty by Governor Cuomo and his corrupt leadership who built competitive ventures up in Wyander on I-84. That's one replacement for Indian Point. The other gas plant is CPV over in, again, in upstate New York. It's just, okay, and now we're going to generate more pollution in the city from plants like Ravenswood. It's just, why are we increasing our emissions? I mean, when Vermont Yankee closed, that increased Vermont's emissions for sure. And we are really going to try to decarbonize. We need nuclear. Thank you.
Looks like we have a couple of additional speakers that would like to weigh in. Lynn Bruning, why don't you unmute?
Hi, this is Lynn. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Lynn Bruning, I'm fifth generation in Duanesburg, Schenectady County, New York. And something that I'm not hearing addressed is the fact that a disproportionate amount of solar and wind power plants will be sited throughout upstate and rural New York. Many of these counties have the lowest average mean income, and the residents are not afforded the privilege of having the time, money, and resources to be heard, to be present at meetings, and to protect their properties from what they consider to be unsightly, unwanted, and unneeded industrial infrastructure in their rural environment. Our comprehensive plans will state that we live in these communities for our rural views and the rural lifestyle. To have the burden of the construction and the loss of views so that downstate and frequently even power purchase agreements out of state are afforded clean energy does not seem equitable to me. What I see happening is New York State policy is actually increasing, exponentially increasing the number of frontline communities throughout New York State. And I think, you know, this just simply is not an equitable solution. We need to focus on dense power sources, and that would be nuclear. Otherwise, we are just simply polluting our rural landscape with intermittent and unreliable power sources. Thank you for your consideration.
Gary Krellenstein.
Hi, this is Mike Levin from Generate Capital. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, so yeah, I appreciate everyone's views on the subject, and I'm truly in a technology agnostic, and you know, I just haven't heard, you know, I live in California for now, and I was here with raising my kids when the Fukushima disaster happened, and definitely affected my life the many thousands of miles away though it was. So going back to the idea of technology, being technology agnostic, I think the CLCPA does need to improve some of its scope in terms of what's considered clean and renewable waste to electricity and aerobic digesters. the status should be corrected with the CLCPA. We could look towards hydrogen fuel cells and thinking about New York on a regional basis might help there. Storage for solar and other intermittent electricity storage has come of age, and any way that it can help the grid should also be somehow rewarded with market signals for its use to the grid. Yeah, I think keeping the focus on the technology side on stable, local, clean, and cheaper for the consumer, job creation also, I'm in favor of all clean energy technologies, and I think the CLCPA should expand its thinking on the different technologies in the New York context.
Great, thank you, Micah. Gary Krellenstein.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, thank you so much for your time. I've been listening to the questions being asked, and there's been quite a number of good ones. Question as to whether or not you were aware that the National Academy of Science and Engineering released a report in the last 2 days stressing how we could get to zero carbon emission, and that it would be feasible but difficult. But one of the key conclusions they reached was that we must maintain the existing nuclear power that we can in order to achieve this goal. And I was curious if you could explain to me why there is no one on this panel that seems to have any experience or expertise in nuclear. Was it pre-decided before the panel was set up that nuclear would not be under consideration? Or was it something that we want to at least explore before making a final determination? That's my comment for today.
Great.
Great, thank you, Gary. Any of the parents would like to weigh in, they should feel free. Otherwise, I would think at this point, it does not seem like there are other members of the public interested in commenting at this point. I would now like to offer the panelists the opportunity. We've heard for the last hour and a half a wide range of members of the public step forward to provide their thoughts on the power generation and how and its recommendations to the Climate Action Council. Any of the panelists would like to comment generally on anything that has been brought up here? We'd like to give you the opportunity to do so.
This is John Rhodes. I'm not going to respond to all that specifically, Jeremy, other than to just go on record as appreciating and committing to take very seriously the various comments that have been made. I know that there's been a thread of pro-nuclear, pro-nuclear environmentalism that's been quite a presence in this chat, and all I can say is assure everybody that there's nothing nefarious in the composition of the panel. It was the panel was selected by the Climate Action Council after a lot of input and a lot of deliberation. The charge was not to have any bias other than to make the most helpful recommendations. I would have a hard time reading the lack of nuclear engineering expertise on the panel as indicating any particular inclination or disinclination. But other than that, I just want to not speak too much for the panel colleagues, other than to say we will take all this input seriously and weigh it, and hopefully be able to respond with better recommendations than we would have without this input. As I mentioned early when we kicked off, you'll have another couple of bites at the apple, dear members of the public, on the 12th and the 22nd, when we add a public input session explicitly to our panel meeting that's considering draft recommendations. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Rhodes. Are there any panelists that would like to comment on anything that has been submitted today? Yes, Darren, if you'd like to unmute and comment, feel free.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you very much. I just wanted to thank everybody and echo Chairman Rhodes' comments that we really appreciate everybody spending time to share with us their input, and know that certainly that many of the items brought up today will be many of us certainly heard them and appreciate everyone in sharing their opinions and thoughts and ideas. And that particularly, I think it certainly goes without, it should be said, is that nuclear has not been forgotten by any means, looking at the power generation mix. But all resources are certainly looked at and evaluated and part of the discussion. So I appreciate everybody spending their time and making sure that nothing gets forgotten and bringing their own personal stories to share.
We have a couple of more general questions. Will the draft recommendations be made available to the public in advance of the next meetings? I can't comment on that myself, but I don't know if there are any members of the panel would like to, or Chairman Rhodes would be able to weigh in on that.
We haven't sorted out the mechanics of that yet, but certainly, if it's at all possible, we get that it would be it would make for a better process and a better meeting and a better platform for engagement all around. So that's our hope.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for taking the time. For those who spoke, thank you for taking the time to provide your thoughts. If you did not get a chance to speak, or there's additional information that you wanted to submit to this panel, again, we encourage you to email written comments to powergenpanel@dps.nny.gov. You may also call toll-free the PowerGen public input line at 1-833-498-2082. Again, there we will have another public input session, I believe next week. We will have an additional opportunity next Friday to provide public input on the draft recommendations that will be discussed by the panel, and similarly 10 days after that. With that, I think we will close out the session. Thank you to the panelists and to all members of the public who participated in this session.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody.
Thank you.
Oh.